Hello, I am Greg Livingston, and I am here with. Please introduce yourselves.
I'm Craig Stevenson. I'm a game designer for Pixelbot Games, and we're working on our game Canary.
And I'm Rob Hafey. I'm also with Pixelbot Games, and I'm doing the programming for Canary.
Nice. Glad to meet you. So Canary is this survival roguelike sort of thing where you travel through really dark dungeons. You don't have a lot of light to see by, and you go down floor by floor trying to avoid enemies. And one of the things that really struck me about the demo at Gamescape was how dark the screen is, and you're really dependent on that flashlight and on that radar scope. So I wanted to ask, how did you decide how much to show the player?
It's actually kind of interesting. The Canary, before there was Canary, there was this smaller Flash game that I built a few years back that was sort of like a game jam kind of game. And it was the main concept of light and dark was sort of like the focus or the challenge. Like, how do you handle like a resource that is running out, like in an active game, like an action game, as opposed to like a real-time strategy game or something like that. And so actually in that game, the distance that your light, the cone of your light, controlled your entire visibility of the scene. So as your light beam went down, the sphere of darkness would increase as well. So actually in Canary, it's a little bit different with it switching from a 2D to a 3D environment, and sort of like playing with the way light reacts, and we have like sort of a larger cone that sort of stays stationary. And that was sort of just came out of testing, as we found people who would play the game were surprisingly, well, maybe not surprisingly, but they were certainly more cautious as they played. Most of the level takes place, as you mentioned, in a dark void, and there's just a small amount of visibility, and people were very afraid to take the next step. And so sort of after testing and giving people a light that stayed on as opposed to the original Flash game, that was much, much difficult, much harder than what we're doing now, made it so that people were a little bit less afraid to keep playing, so to speak, or at least afraid to risk losing a life.
So you gave players enough to see by and so that they feel comfortable to venture forward. But then I guess the opposite side of that would be what is the point of limiting the player's sight?
Sure. Well, it's really to tie in the mechanic of the resource management. So everything that you do in the game takes an amount of energy, including using your light over time. And so, and as you mentioned, the sonar ability, which is super important to players because it is the one thing that gives them visibility a little bit wider in the dark. And so by giving them by making it as dark and as low visibility as we have, it does create that tension that you have. And when you get bits of light from things like the plants and the reeds that are coming up out of the basalt rocks, you get a little bit of a reprieve from the complete darkness. So it's really to build tension and to create that sense of danger all around you and the unknown. But it also helps with exploration too. So because you can't see what's coming out in front of you, it's interesting to find out what's over that ledge if you take a path one way or another. At least that's the way I see it.
Okay. It's interesting in that perspective then that oftentimes in roguelikes or survival horror, resource management comes down to a number in a menu somewhere, like how many bullets are left in my gun or how many health packs I have. And in Canary, you've mapped that sense of resource management to an actual space that I can see on the screen. Okay. So
That's sort of the idea. And I mean, and it the way that we've set it up, at least our goal with it is to sort of support multiple play styles. So I've seen some players who, when they play, they'll turn the headlamp on, for instance, which is just a which is constantly burning down units of energy as it's on, and they'll spin the light around almost like the way a police siren or police lights would work, and they'll it give themselves this constant strobe of visibility, which was actually a really interesting technique I hadn't seen before. But when you do something like that, you get your visibility back, but you burn through all of your resources. And in our game, there's these energy crystals that are sort of pickups that allow that you can mine with your light to sort of regain some of that energy. But if you spent too much early on, then you don't have that ability later on. You sort of can run yourself into this situation where you're all out of energy because you've burned up too much. So some players who like want to speed run through something like this can do so if they're careful, if they're not running their light all the time, because they'll have enough energy to make it all the way through. But otherwise, they, you know, they'll burn up pretty quick and they won't get very far.
Yeah, I think that also, you know, the concept of using energy for everything, that kind of evolved as we let more people play it. And as we experimented with playing it ourselves, it was very interesting, you know, to tie all the elements together. And I think you agree, Craig, it wasn't necessarily part of the complete design from the beginning to include energy in everything.
Right.
And so it's been a nice evolution of game design. And I think it ties everything together to force the player to think about everything they do and use. Of course, it's going to make it a little more challenging to tune the levels. But, I really like that concept of, you know, so anyway.
Yeah, that's a neat point that there's this abstract system in the background that rules over everything, and so how much you use your light it influences how much you can use all of your other items, and keeps you from feeling like honestly, I really just think of Banjo-Kazooie, and whenever you would pick up an item, there would be like a laundry list of things on the left hand side of the screen, and it just felt like you had a bunch of random stuff. So, Craig, you kind of started to touch on this, and I wanted to get into it more. How does a player decide where to explore and where not to explore?
Right now, so just to sort of give a little bit of information on our progress, we've sort of been working on it for quite a while, and as Rob alluded to, we've iterated a couple times. And right now, what we have is a concept of the plan to essentially have handcrafted levels, which mostly consist of linear path environments that are mixed in with procedurally generated environments, which is sort of like the next step we're about to embark on.
So when you say mixed in with, is it like every other floor would be procedural or?
Yeah, so the concept that we're playing with now, and this is still up in the air, so it's subject to change, but What we'd like to do is essentially have handcrafted levels that will help us tell a story that'll pull the player through and actually add little bits of narrative in that are intermixed with the procedural levels. So essentially what you're saying, yeah, you'd have a static layer or an elevation is what we tend to refer it to that includes, you know, 6 or 8 different room engagements that are handcrafted, and then you'd go through a series of elevations that were procedurally set up where the rooms change as you go through, and then your progress would trigger the next story layer is essentially the idea. But as far as your question goes, so right now the story are more linear. They're sort of like one exit out, but the design itself is to encourage people to travel down multiple branches. So the way we have our system set up and the way Rob's created the level editor and the procedural generation, as far as we have it now, is that we can create, you know, a chamber or a room and then sort of like branch, align the branches however we want. So if we need to connect a room as like a sub room off of another, or we need to have branching hallways, or we need to have changes in elevation, the system can do that. And it's a procedural setup. With us, with, you know, a series of handles for us to tweak. But I don't know if, Rob, if you want to talk more about the way that works. But the as far as from the player perspective goes, we want to encourage exploration that takes you down different paths. And we have rooms that are set up that are challenging you either as a platforming challenge or as a combat challenge, as well as things like vistas that are going to show off the world and give you a sense of navigation, as well as treasure rooms where you'll have the ability to upgrade, find upgrades from your character and you know, mine mine the crystals that will, you know, keep you going.
Yeah, so that's part of the balance is being able to, you know, design the level such that maybe the treasure room is difficult to get to, for instance. So you would have to, number one, find it, and then you'd have to be able to, conquer the enemies in order to get there. So that would definitely be part of, a critical component in the game to be able to collect enough energy to continue. So by tying the energy into having to explore, then that as another element that's interesting from the game design in that it's not that you're just battling endless ways of enemies, but you actually have to manage your resources at the same time. So anyway.
Okay. So could there be a hypothetical scenario where I reach the end of the floor, but I decide to backtrack and keep exploring for a treasure room or something like that?
Yes, exactly. Yeah, so there's freedom in the way that we have the system set up that you can sort of tree branch the design, and you can have dead ends, and you can have where you would need to backtrack. There's certainly nothing that would prevent that from being set up. Yeah,
and the system now, I guess in the current iteration, we're hoping to have very nicely well lit rooms that are handcrafted. Again, procedurally connected with in a random way with other rooms in a structure. So basically, Craig would be able to kind of decide, which rooms would be included on a particular elevation. But every time you went into that elevation, you may find the rooms in a different position, or their elevation and Y is changed. They're branching in X and Z, you really don't know where anything's going to end up, in the second time through. So that can make it, more interesting. We can also randomize the rooms, on that particular elevation as well. So we're playing around with all of these ideas to get the best game balance.
Okay.
Yeah, and that ties into like the typical like roguelike setup where really what the player is mastering is they're getting better at platforming, and they're getting better at combat or the defensive combat that we have. And so you can't memorize the room, you can't necessarily jump this gap every time when you walk in, because that gap may not be there the next time you're there. But you can get better at dealing with spiders that explode and don't run from you, or lampreys that jump out of the floor and try and eat you. The parts that I love about roguelikes, anyway.
So, Rob, then there must be some way to balance how often enemies versus resources appear and how much space you would have to explore and to bump into both camps.
Yeah, I mean, that's right now we're in the experimental stage, I guess, in that, the nav system that we're using, basically A-Star, it has some limitations. And so there's Craig's, interest in having this ginormous world that goes on forever. And then the limitations of actually how much we can load into the scene and render it at any one time, which is, I think, a very typical problem. So we kind of always battle back and forth on that. But as far as, resource management for a particular level, I mean, that really comes down to like a more of a game design balance, I think, meaning that, that's where it's going to get tricky, to make sure that we have the right amount of energy, overall, in the scene. So for instance, if we had fixed rooms that, maybe there are many of them, but each one of them has a certain amount of resource or a certain amount of enemy, I can easily guarantee that for any one particular level, you might encounter, three or four enemy factories, and then this many power-up crystals, and this many, alien grass power-ups. And, it's very easy to manage the distribution. But, it's more, I think the more difficult part is just, you know, tuning it so it plays well on, you know, when you're generating a procedural level. So we're still working on that, but that's kind of the fun part.
Yeah. All right.
Lots and lots of play testing.
Yes. And it's good feedback, you know, going to show the game, sitting down with players and really finding out that, you know, well, they really don't understand, you know, what we're trying to convey. And so we need to, you know, adapt maybe the tutorial or the design to, you know, have them, let them have a better experience. So that's why it was nice going to that show, this last show.
We got
a lot of feedback.
Yeah, that's been sort of like the best thing that we've done so far. I mean, we showed Canary a while back at the Video Gamers United show that was in D.C. I think, was that months ago or last year even. And that when we get an opportunity to sort of show the demo to people and get their feedback and see how they play, we just get so much more information out of what we're doing and what's working, what's not, what needs to be tweaked. And that's sort of like our own little playtest sessions at these shows, as well as a good chance to get the word out about what we're doing.
Yeah. I'm sure playtesting must be, you know, awfully important in all kinds of game development, but it strikes me as particularly relevant to procedural generation where communicating to the player operates on a much more like abstract level.
Right.
Rather than something you can explicitly design.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely. I mean, I think when you look at some of the great examples of roguelikes, I can't imagine the amount of hours that have gone into making a lot of those and the balance that goes into them. And sometimes you still have mistakes. I mean, like, I think about when I first started playing, like, Spelunky, for instance, which I'm a huge fan of. They do such a nice job of ushering you in by giving you those three static levels before you start.
Huh.
So you understand the mechanics a little bit. Like your first rooms, you're not playing as you, you're playing as this character who's telling the story of how they've fallen into this mind that has sort of like warped time and space to repeat itself. Which is a great way, you know, and it's a little bit forgiving. If you die, you know, you can restart at the I think you have like three hearts or something like that, and you can continue to play through, and that really helps to learn. Okay, like you get your first enemy encounter, and you learn how to use your whip, you learn how to use your rope, and things like that, and that's sort of the way to usher you in. But then once you're past that, and you're actually in the full game of Spelunky, it can vary greatly in difficulty just because of that, and I think that's something that's sort of the fun challenge for the type of player who loves the kind of game that makes you want to throw the controller, but can also make people run away. So I think it you sort of narrow your audience a little bit when you go after mechanics like roguelikes.
So based on that, actually, what kind of knowledge would the player have upon entering a procedurally generated area?
I mean, I think our goal could, because we haven't built our tutorial yet, really. Is sort of to answer that in a similar way, at least for me. That's the way Spelunky did it. And that's sort of to like introduce in a safe environment, you know, that your light's important, energy management's important, everything that you do takes energy, teaching those basic rules of the world, and then sort of safely introduce them to their first enemy kind of thing. Because other than that, it's sort of, you know, it feels unfair if you don't know those things, you know, because it's like, and we know that from ourselves, because obviously we're internally playing through this. So it's like, oh, yeah, we know this, we know this, we know this. And then to watch someone new play with it, and they're like, and I'm just like, well, why aren't they running? Like, there's no way they're going to make that jump. Why don't they run? And it's like, you know it before they even get close to the ledge. And it's just like, oh, but you've got so far. And I want to tell them, but I don't, because I need them to, like, you know, do what they want to do.
Right.
So I can observe that.
I go ahead and tell them.
And it's like,
because I'm the nice guy, okay?
Yeah, apparently Rob's the nice guy. But then I'm like, oh, well, obviously. You know, that's a huge learning point for me, because it's like, okay, we need to focus on these little things that are obviously important. And it's like, duh, well, of course, but we've been, you know, we've had our heads in the nuts and bolts and not the top level stuff because we've been working on it for so long.
So
it was interesting. It was interesting too at Gamescape, trying to teach like 100 different people how to play in like 2 or 3 minutes. That really was the guide that we need to have in the tutorial.
Yeah.
You know, there's not really that many things, but all of those things need to be conveyed. And hopefully in a clever way. I mean, we want to try to avoid, you know, having it be like in your face too much, you know, some exploration, but, you know, so that's what we want to work on, a kind of a interesting, tutorial, teaching process. So anyway.
Okay. It almost sounds like, maybe your guideline is to introduce all of the elements that the player might encounter and then say, you're going to encounter all these in a random arrangement.
And Rob's being really nice by not throwing me under a bus, but like my huge pet peeve when it comes to games is like the blatant system layer over top of the game, which some players could care less, right? Because what's important is the game. But like to me, I can't stand it when I get a pop-up that's like, here, you're going to need to do this now. I'm just like, no, I don't want to read that sheet of information that will make it so that I can play, because this isn't a board game. You know, I want to experience it. And so that's really hard to do. You know, it's not that it's a difficult thing. Like that first 15 minutes or 10 minutes of anyone playing a game, it's like you're trying to get your bearings of, okay, what is this about? What am I supposed to do? What do they want me to do? What do I want to do? How do I do it? And that part is tough to package into a nice, entertaining, it really is the right word, way. And I think for us, the attempt is to try and do it through story and introducing the character and why you're there and what's your motivation, and then sort of letting that unfold so you knew exactly, you know, what to do, because you find out who you are and what you're there for.
Right. What you have to do makes more sense if you know the reason why.
Right, right.
I actually, personally, like, I don't care about the fiction of games at all, but mm-hmm. I also find I just learn really poorly from text.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think most people do. You know, Craig and I run into that problem in our day job, you know, all the time, because people just don't read anything. And
yeah.
So. And including me. I don't even read Craig's game design documents. So,
yeah.
which is most annoying to him, because but I love to sit and talk about it. So
it's little fun challenges like that. So it makes it so great.
Yeah, maybe if the game design document were displayed in a playable tutorial.
Exactly.
Yeah, see, there you go. Then I might actually read it.
Yeah. Number one, become better programmer. That's on my list of things to do, Rob. I'll program the design docs.
And maybe become a better game designer. Isn't that scary? No, actually, Craig and I argue about game design just about every day for like probably an hour a day. Like, no, that'll never work. And then we argue and argue and argue, which I think ultimately makes things better, you know?
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, it's good when you don't have an echo chamber and you have someone to challenge your opinions.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
So also on the topic of exploration, I wanted to hit on how combat was relevant to exploration. And I actually think, Craig, you mentioned this to me at Gamescape, that you envisioned Canary as having defensive combat. And I was wondering if you could explain that.
Yeah, sure. So basically, in the game itself, you play as Lumen, which is a light utility bot. And in the concept of the game is, you know, we're set in the future and we're mining asteroids, and we've used up all of Earth's natural resources. And so we use human pilots to remote control robots who then do the mining for us. And in our demo that you got to play, Lumen has landed on this planet where a mining ship crash landed. And so you control the little robot that has the light. And in our world, it's a subterranean environment. So all the alien life that exists underground inside these caves, and they've never seen the light of day. And you happen to be a little light robot. And so that's beneficial to you because everyone's afraid of your light. And in the game, you basically we have dual stick controls. So your robot's moving with the left and your light can be moved with your right. And because it's a top down world, that's beneficial because you have enemies that can come at you from any side. And you sort of herd your light or herd the enemies with your light into, I guess you could call them hazards. Most of the world exists with a void around you. And if you can get them off of the platform you're on, you're kind of safe. Or if you can herd them into pits of lava or water, anything to get them away from you is sort of how you combat them. There's not like an active gun that you can shoot. And I think for us that sort of is one of the things that really sets the game apart is that there is no bazooka button to blow everything up. You can't nuke anything. And it's something I still advocate for because to me, I like it. I think it's actually more challenging. People look at it and they say, oh, this looks pretty simple. And then when they try it, it does present more of a challenge to do stuff like that, to introduce like a herding mechanic in the AI, as opposed to just pointing a gun and shooting at them from a distance and, you know, killing them off. But that's sort of basically, in a nutshell, what the defensive combat is about. And for me, it creates a lot of fun level design opportunities because I think of every room and chamber a new way to sort of challenge the player to use their light in an intelligent way. So you're not just running in and it's like, bug there, shoot. It's like, okay, I'm in a dark room. I've got three of these things following me. One of them isn't afraid of my light and will blow me up if it gets too close. I need to find the pit before they all eat me and my battery's about to go out. Like, and that to me is a stressful situation that I want to be able to put the player in and have them try and find the safe spot to stop and think, maybe throw their sonar out and figure out where that pit is or go over to a corner and explore. And, you know, is it on the left side? Is it on the right side? I'm not really sure. Okay, now I need to divide and conquer. I can drop down a flare. It'll create this sphere of light around me as a protection and give me a moment to pull, you know, to separate the enemies and divide and conquer. That's how at least I think of the way the rooms work. And that's sort of the experience that I'm trying to create with the rooms in there. And I think that's something a little bit different than people have seen before.
So exploration comes to bear in having to find methods of killing your enemies. You won't necessarily see where pits are, but also that because you can herd enemies, you could potentially herd them into some place you want to get to, right?
Exactly. Yeah, so you have like that dual challenge of where's my safe place, where's my exit, but where's the place that will either pen these guys up or get them away from me or, you know, throw them off the edge, so to speak.
Yeah, and then and make sure before you get to that room or place where these enemies are that you have enough energy, that you've actually done the necessary exploring to find the energy you need. So that adds yet another level of tension, I think.
Right, it's that idea that energy is relevant to everything.
Right.
Yeah, so we're even debating whether, you know, you can extract the energy from an enemy that you end up pushing off the cliff or burning, you know, so to speak, with your, you know, some of the spiders, the fire bugs you can actually burn, you know, whether you can collect the energy from them. So it's just a game design issue. You know, it's a story design. A story issue, really, right? Because programming is easy, but it's a question of what works for the story.
Yeah.
So that's
and the gameplay, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, Canary seems really interesting so far. Before we go, I wanted to ask more of a conceptual question that I like to run by everybody individually. So, Craig, when it comes to game design, not necessarily in terms of Canary, but just discussing video games in general, what's more important, the game in itself, the intention of the developer, or the experience of the player?
Huh. That is an interesting question. I hate to cop out, but I feel like all three of them are really, really important. I think there's probably some weight to the experience of the player, because in the end, we're creating a medium that is to be consumed by players, and the goal is really to make our players happy. So I think that's probably the highest weight. But at the same time, especially when you look at independent development, you definitely feel like they're the group of people that created the product are, were trying to give you an experience. At least that's the way I see it from the development side. You know, when I play these games, I think about the choices that the designer made or the developers made because they wanted you to experience something that, that came out of their heads that they worked really, really hard on and cared a lot about. So I think it's really important too what the developer wanted. And in that case, the game too. I mean, it's sort of, you know, to me, when I look at games, or the game, what I should say is the games I like to play the most are games that sort of surprise me, because I don't necessarily need to play the same game twice. And when someone's trying to do something completely different or tweak a particular aspect of a genre, that's when they really stand out to me. So in that aspect, the game's also important because what is it what is it doing to advance, you know, the genre that it comes from, so to speak.
Yeah.
So yeah, sorry, but that was like all three of those. I wasn't really picking one.
No, well, that counts. And Rob, which would you consider more important?
I think the player experience is probably the most important to me. And actually, what's really most important to me is that I actually enjoy playing it because, you know, at the end of the day, we put elements in the game that we both like, and we argue about what we like and what should be there. And so, you know, I think it's really, the economy is really important. Plus, you know, from a programming point of view, it's interesting, you know, to keep track of everything and, you know, make it an important issue. And I think that if the game has a little more meat to it and there's like this separate economy that you have to pay attention to, plus you have the sort of arcadey, you know, direction of having to herd enemies and you're running around and jumping and, you know, platforming. And so, you know, it's dynamic and it's fun and it has an economy. So, but in the end, you know, I enjoy it when somebody can sit down and play it. So I would say that, you know, it's for the player, you know, more than it is for me. So I just want it to be fun. So, okay.
Yeah, I think actually there of that reminds me of a good point. Like, we didn't really touch on was that we've started to develop, a whole second mode of the game. You could, so to speak. And that really was born out of Rob's love for the games that he plays. Whereas I wanted this sort of like story experience. I wanted to tell a story in a game that used procedural mechanics, which I hadn't really seen a whole lot of. Rob really loved like the arcade aspect of playing and also still loved that interesting mechanic with the defensive combat. And so we built Swarm Mode, which we showed at Gamescape, where, you know, it's essentially a wave defense where you've got waves of enemies that change through each wave, and you have to sort of kill them in this arena type level. So the light and dark isn't as much of an issue. You can boost your character up really high, and just basically see how long you can stay alive. But that was all born out of the fact that Rob really likes to play that style of game, and I think it worked well still with our mechanics, and it made sense to build a second mode. And I really, really like local multiplayer games, so that there was there that too.
Right, and I think ultimately what will happen is the wave mode will probably get incorporated into the story in one way or another. In fact, in some of the later, if you go a little deeper in the story level, you will get a more arcade experience. So, but you won't necessarily have waves of enemies, but, you know, it could be that we have waves of enemies without us saying, you know, here comes a wave, you know what I mean? So
yeah.
we can perfect that arcade experience as part of maybe one whole level that you would drop down to, where you drop down to this level and it's just like just infested with enemies that are coming at you, and you have to, you know, get rid of them all before you can continue. You know, it's like a boss level kind of thing. So I also like both. I mean, I wouldn't be you know, bothering with the story part, you know, if I didn't really love that part too. But I think I was looking for something, you know, a little more, you know, to the action side of things. And I, like I said, I think we'll end up putting both together and then may not have that arcade mode unless we're doing like local multiplayer, is what I'm kind of guessing.
Okay. So let me ask, which one of you is better at Canary?
Me, for sure. I don't know. We've never actually tested this. So that's easy enough to do. We could totally have a competition.
It's not really fair, I don't think, because...
I don't know what you mean.
Because in the story mode, you design the levels. So it's like, I've got to go explore the levels and figure out where everything is. You already know where everything is, okay? So given enough time, I think I could still kick your ass. So I am very competitive, so...
I couldn't tell.
Exactly.
Before we go, is there anything you guys would like to plug?
If anyone's wants to check out Canary, we're going to be releasing the Gamescape demo within a few weeks from our like social outlets. We're on Facebook. You can check us out, facebook.com/pixelbotgames. You can check out our game page, which is canarygame.com, as well as we have a subreddit at Canary Game as well. And we're on Twitter, Pixelbot Games. I think that's all of the social avenues.
Yeah. I think you hit them all. So.
Yeah.
Nice. Well, great having both of you.
Yeah, thank you so much for taking time to talk to us. And thanks for checking out our game at Gamescape.
Yeah, my pleasure.